This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I am Cherry Gregg. I'm sipping my coffee right now, sitting right beside me. Did you have your coffee today, Avi?
I did. Not enough. And it was a lot, but it wasn't enough somehow. And it was free, which was great. That was the best part, because I got it from Wawa, and all the Wawa coffee is free today because it's their birthday, their anniversary. So I got a big old 24-ounce of coffee from Wawa, and somehow it's just not hitting. I don't know what's going on today, Cherry.
You need to get the bold, man. But I love it when they have free
coffee. That's
right.
I went for the regular. That was the problem, not the dark roast.
For sure.
So we're going to get into gear, though, on Studio 2 today. Cherry, what do we got coming up?
Well, in just a few minutes, we're talking with Sarah Barnett, who's the executive director of ACT Philly. There's a dog flu outbreak, and it has put ACT in crisis mode. We'll also hear from Joseph Earl Thomas. He's a Philadelphia native whose memoir about growing up in the Frankfurt section of Philly received widespread acclaim. Looking forward to that.
And then later, this will perk me up. We're going to do some Studio 2 trivia. Our contestant will be ready shortly. That's our live trivia contest.
Yay.
We do that every Thursday. And then every Thursday, we end the show with a list of things to check out this weekend all over the region. So you'll want to listen to that. First, we've got our news roundup. Every day we do our news roundup. We're starting in Bucks County, specifically the Central Bucks School District. If you didn't catch this, our own WHYY suburban reporter Emily Rizzo had a fantastic story on WHYY.org this morning about the Central Bucks School District using this software called Go Guardian Beacon. This is a software that scans everything students do on a school-issued device, search terms, emails, social media, etc. And then what they claim is that they use artificial intelligence to sift through all of that data and flag students who could be a threat to themselves or to others. Central Bucks is using this on a trial basis through the end of the year. But basically what it means is any student, middle or high school, through the end of this year will be surveyed by this software. About 40 school districts across Pennsylvania use this software already. 10,000 districts nationwide. And of course, it raises all sorts of questions about privacy and efficacy. And so Emily really dug in, and you should absolutely check out the story because she really dug in on this topic.
Yeah, and I have to say, I am concerned about privacy. I also am a little concerned that students who will get flagged, who shouldn't be flagged, mm-hmm. could be an innocent comment, what have you. Also, it could have a chilling effect on students wanting to share on social media, because if they think they'll get flagged, and especially if people start, they flag one wrong person and they see a negative impact, kids may then, you know, the only real outlet they have, they may stop using it and then parents will never know.
Right. The problem they're trying to address, and I think people probably understand this, is that there is a rise in the number of teenagers feeling depressed or considering suicide, and they're trying to help students before they reach a crisis point. Is this the best way to do that? More and more districts apparently think it is the right way to do that. And I do think this is a trend we're going to continue to see. I mean, this is the technology future in terms of school surveillance.
Yeah. And we're going back and forth with AI. You know, we just talked about ChatGPT just a few days ago. And so we have this push-pull tension with artificial intelligence. So I'm going to move on, and we're going to go down to Delaware now.
Let's do it.
And it's been 2 weeks since the Delaware General Assembly passed measures that would legalize recreational use of marijuana and create a marketplace there. And so far, guess what we've heard from Governor John Carney? Nothing, okay? Crickets.
The sound that I made, silence.
Crickets. Crickets, okay? The two bills that have been passed, they would, you know, legalize recreational marijuana, something folks have been pushing for multiple cycles here in the legislature. And they will also set up that marketplace. They were passed by the legislature March 28th. It's April 13th. Nothing. Now, I should mention that Governor John Carney, he's vetoed this type of legislation before. But at this point, he has not said anything publicly about these bills before him. Bills become law after 10 days if the governor doesn't sign or veto them. And 10 days have passed since the legislature voted. But the clock doesn't really begin until the bills are formally sent to the governor's desk, and no one knows.
If it's been sent.
If it's been sent.
Isn't that weird? Schoolhouse Rock made it seem so simple, right? The bill goes to the legislature, then it goes up the steps to the White House. But in this case, it's a mystery. I don't know. Is cannabis legal in Delaware?
I don't know.
We'll find out eventually, but we actually just don't know if these bills, this package, has been sent to the governor's desk. If it has, then there is a ticking clock, and these bills would phase into law if Carney does nothing.
Yeah, and I will say Governor Carney knows how to sign a bill that he wants, and he will sign it the day of, but
that's right.
Now it's just lingering. So there you go.
So actually, I wanted to transition us now to our newsmaker interview for today. We're talking about a crisis in Philly's only open intake animal shelter. The problem is overcrowding, and it's a problem made worse by an outbreak of dog flu. Shelter staff now face difficult decisions, and they're asking for the public's help. So to break it all down and explain it, we've brought in Sarah Barnett, Executive Director of ACT, that stands for the Animal Care and Control Team of Philadelphia. Sarah Barnett, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me to talk about this. We're really grateful to you guys.
Yeah, so I just remember that during the height of the pandemic, everybody wanted a pet, and everybody was getting a pet. Talk about how this is having an impact on the number of pets you all have in your shelter right now.
Up until April, the issue that we really saw was that everybody who wanted to adopt did so during the pandemic. Everyone who wanted to foster did so. And so the issue that we're having right now is just that there aren't enough fosters or adopters for all the dogs. Mm-hmm. And what that has really led to is animals coming in and not leaving as quickly, particularly dogs. Cats were having, you know, pretty good numbers moving out to rescues and adopters, but nobody is really looking to adopt a 50-pound large dog right now. And I think inflation has a big part of it. We're seeing a lot of dogs surrendered for housing-related issues, evictions, moving, unable to afford basic vet care. So we're seeing a lot of dogs coming in for that reason as well. And what's exacerbated it is a lot of people don't remember this, but during the pandemic, of course, not only did you guys not go out and socialize, but neither did your dogs.
Yeah.
So a lot of the dogs coming in haven't been around other dogs a ton or are just stressed out. You know, during the pandemic, they were used to somebody home all the time, and now they're not. And the biggest part of that is their immunity. The immunity that so many people rely on for everything isn't really there. And so canine flu this year nationwide is taking out shelters left and right. There are multiple shelters across the country that have had to do this where they've actually had to close for a month.
Wow.
And that would be the ideal, honestly, would be if we could close for a month. But because we're the only facility, we take in about 400 dogs a month. And these are dogs that are not always in great shape. They need us. We're their last resort. You know, we had a line of people outside of our door this morning to surrender pets. Someone joked, like, do you have Taylor Swift tickets? And we're like, no, we're just taking in dogs that people can't care for anymore. And we're very upfront with them. And, you know, people, I think there's so much going on right now in people's lives that it's a decision that they feel they have to make. So they've come to terms with it. So by the time they come to us, they're not looking for the resources to keep their pet. They want to give them up. So we're seeing that. And that's what's really led to this crisis that we're now, which is that we have, you know, over 100 dogs in our building. And because of that, you know, we're seeing a lot of canine flu. And canine flu is very, very contagious. And we don't want to keep adopting out animals that have an illness or have been exposed to one. That's not a great experience for adopters. So that's really why we're doing this now.
And so describe what canine flu is. Is it similar to what we understand as the flu? And what are the symptoms and what's the prognosis for a dog that has it?
So out of the shelter, the prognosis is not that bad.
Okay.
You know, there's a mild form and a severe form. It's sneezing, coughing, nasal discharge. You know, it's the flu.
Yeah.
There's two forms of it. The one that we're seeing is those are the symptoms of it. And you're seeing it in daycare facilities, PetSmarts, you know, Petcos, everywhere. Dog park right now I would stay away from just because, again, most dogs are not immune to it. And the vaccine takes about a month to take effect and is on back order. So nobody can really get the vaccine anyways. The issue in the shelter is stress makes it worse and underlying health conditions make it worse. So when we get in dogs who are not in great shape and they get sick and they're stressed, those are all factors that really lead to them needing hospitalization many times. So that's the other reason we're asking not only for people to take dogs, but if people can't take dogs to make a donation, we've spent tens of thousands of dollars in medical care for some of these dogs.
Yeah, and you gave some of the symptoms, but how do you know whether or not your dog has it? I mean, if they just start coughing?
Yeah, I mean, if they've been, think too about where you've had your dog. So if you've been to the dog park and you notice 2 days later they're starting to cough, or maybe they seem a little bit lethargic, they're not eating as much food, basically, anything that seems off, we suggest going to the vet right away, because the biggest thing we've seen with this is people who wait. people who wait, and then it requires hospitalization, and you're paying a ton of money, and it's viral, so you do have to let it run its course. But providing supportive care is really critical. So doing that from day one, you know, making sure that they're getting in the steam shower with you, or making sure that you're at least not spreading it to other dogs in the community by taking them back to the dog park. So think through to where your dog has been that they might have been exposed.
And how easy, it's very contagious.
It's very contagious.
And how do they pass it from dog to dog?
So yeah. 80% of dogs who are exposed end up getting it. So it's very high contagious. It spreads through the air. So it does die quickly in the air. But again, if you're at a dog park or something, those, you know, it does spread rather quickly. Nose to nose, you know, contact with other dogs who are exposed or sick. You can have dogs who are not symptomatic, who are contagious. They stay contagious for up to 21 days. So that's part of the big issue, is that your dog might start to get better and not have symptoms, and you think, awesome, they're great, and they're still spreading the virus.
So what is the dilemma facing your shelter right now? Because you've got a crowded shelter, you have this contagious disease running through it, and you said, you know, in a perfect world, you would close and basically, I assume, clean everything, right, and sort of start reset and start fresh. So what are you attempting to do, and what is the dilemma you face right now?
So we're attempting to do a modified version of that. We know we can't close, but what we're going to try to do is Monday, April 24th, we have identified a space within our shelter that we can use to house dogs temporarily. So we're going to house as many as we possibly can house humanely in that space who are sick and exposed. And that's our exposed population. And that means that the rest of the exposed dogs, though, need to be gone by then. So that's kind of the crisis about needing fosters and adopters right now to take these dogs, so that we get down to 50, which is how many we can house in that space. So that's more than half of our capacity that we need to decrease by.
By April 24th.
By April 24th.
50 dogs by April 24th?
No, it's more like 70.
70 dogs.
And that's on top of the dogs coming in. So that's really, you
know, net 70 dogs.
Net 70 dogs. So it's definitely going to be difficult, but we're isolating this part of the building. We won't have staff who are caring for the other dogs be in this part of the building, so it'll be completely separate. It'll be like a shelter within a shelter. So mm-hmm. It's basically two facilities operating out of the same building.
Yeah. And so I want to ask, how can people help? Because, and talk about, I don't know too much about fostering. So is that temporarily taking a dog in?
Yep.
Describe what you need.
Yeah, so fostering, the biggest thing we need right now are fosters who can foster a large dog for a month. Just for a month. And we actually, thanks to a grant, are able to provide them with $400 gift cards as an incentive at the end of that time period. That time period, and it doesn't mean you're taking home a dog who's, you know, deathly ill or anything. Mm-hmm. A lot of the dogs aren't showing that big symptoms, but they are considered exposed. And so we need to keep all those dogs contained, in a sense. So we need people to foster for a month. We provide the supplies. If you need food, enrichment crates, Doggy Style Pets donated a bunch of enrichment items, which is really nice. So we need people to foster and foster large dogs, ideally who do not have other dogs, because we don't want to
have the disease spread.
And briefly, where do they go to get the information about fostering?
ActPhilly.org. So ACCTPhilly.org. You can find out how to foster, you can find out how to adopt, and you can find out how to donate there.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah. And this is a call to action for all the listeners, by the way. So hopefully they hear that. Thanks so much, Sarah. That is Sarah Barnett. She is the executive director of ACT Philly. Coming up, Cherry, we got Philadelphia author Joseph Earl Thomas talking about his acclaimed new memoir, Sink. You did this interview.
I did.
And I'm very excited to hear it.
I am too. It's about his tough childhood growing up in the Frankfurt neighborhood. And he talks about how video games helped him find escape so that he could survive.
Yeah. And pets.
And pets. All
well,
kinds
of
pets.
Really, which is really related to what we just talked about. So we'll hear that interview coming up right here on Studio 2, which you are listening to on WHYY 90.9.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Cherry, I'm excited for this.
Yeah.
Because I've been hearing a lot about this really great interview you had recently with Philadelphia author Joseph Earl Thomas, who has a new memoir called Sink. And it's been getting a lot of acclaim and attention, including from you. You were raving about this book.
Yes. And I mean, you know, we do books on this show.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I mean, you read a book and it's tough. But this one, I started it And within a day and a half or so, I had finished the book.
Straight through.
It was an easy read. And I mean, Joseph Earl Thomas, he's written short stories and essays, but this is really his debut, and he bears all. It's a coming-of-age story about his childhood growing up in the Frankfurt neighborhood in Philly in the 1990s. I loved his writing. I loved his story, but it wasn't always easy to read. He grew up in deep poverty. There was abuse, drugs, and more. And all of this while he was questioning his own sexuality, Avi.
Thomas, I understand, was a sensitive,
smart, curious
kid. And you mentioned this earlier, found his escape in exotic pets
and video games. Yeah, and I spoke to him recently about his memoir, Sync, and started by asking him about his neighborhood. Where you grew up was a big part of the memoir.
Yeah.
Can you describe Frankfurt for folks who have no idea where it's situated and what it was like?
It's like a really weird place because mm-hmm. it's like kind of spread out. We didn't have a lot of public transportation that would go through. And when I was young, we were kind of confined to a couple blocks. Mostly black folks, a couple white folks, everybody mostly around the same kind of socioeconomic bracket. I tried to stay as close as I could to like specific streets, specific encounters that happened in those places in order to build that sense of place and why and how that sense of place becomes important, especially if you're a young black kid who doesn't have a lot of money, whose family doesn't have a lot of money. Place becomes all the more important because of that.
You deal with a number of issues growing up in Frankfurt. You live with your grandparents, your sister, your aunt, who was also a child, by the way. The house was small. You guys were poor. It was a lot of violence going on. And yet you found a number of ways to survive. And I saw forms of escape as the survival techniques. And so the excerpts that I'd love for you to take a look at is like just sort of highlights some of the forms of escape.
Yeah, of course. The game was Crash Bandicoot. Suddenly, Joey was an Indiana Jones-esque bandicoot, an animal he hadn't previously known existed, sprinting through mazes, dodging traps, jumping over pitfalls, and collecting all the Wumpa fruit his bandicoot heart desired. Joey was damn good, as he tended to be with all video games, but never in front of many people before Tim. With the older boy, it was easy to forget the most recent schoolyard stomping from that overage elementary school kid just a few days prior. His mom's most recent jail stint, and even Pop-Pop's gun tucked in the ceiling tile just above their heads. For a moment, Joey stopped wanting to use it on himself or anyone else. For the first time, Joey glimpsed into a future where being a nerdy black boy might turn out okay.
When I was reading the book, there was so much going on. I mean, bullying, name calling, like so many things. But then there was this moment of joy. Tell me what this moment represented for you when you wrote it.
On a broader scale, I do think it's complicated because for most black folks, right, it's difficult to have a moment of pain that is never joy or a moment of joy where there's like never any pain, right? In part because of the ways that we're always being watched, regulated, pre-thought about prior to our own context, after our own context, you know, so you can't really talk about one without the other for me. And video games were one of the earliest things for me that I really got to enjoy, where I felt like I had a moment where my mind was separated from fear, concern, worry, and into thinking about what I actually enjoyed or what I would desire if there were fewer constraints. It's like, what is the thing that I would want to do the most? And a lot of these games ended up being those things for me.
And you were a very, like, intelligent little boy. Seemed to take a lot in and interpret a lot of things. I want to just understand why you saw a need to escape.
I was always kind of obsessed with words. And I was learning most of those words, right, of course, from, like, video games and such. I would ask a lot of questions, and that's kind of a no-no. And, you know, that was like a big no, because it's like the thing, you know, where children are supposed to be seen, not heard. And this is especially true if you're in a house where, like, maybe one of six or seven people is working, so they're not trying to hear what the hell you're saying, you know. Other folks are dealing with their own things, whether that's addiction or trying to avoid prison or violence from other external places. And then here's this little goofy kid who's like a little bit of a smartass, but is also asking a ton of questions about everything. I just would not let anything go and assume that it should be right. And it's funny because I see it in my own kids now sometimes, where there are all these horrible things about the world that we have grown accustomed to, and we just get up and we go to work the next day because we don't have a choice. But if you're a kid and you're curious, you might be like, why would y'all decide to do things like that? What is rent? Why do you have to pay this much for groceries? Why do we even have to work for 40 hours a week? How does that make sense? All these kinds of questions. And there was a version of that really intensely in me that I just kind of would not let go. And I think the kind of constant questioning made things frustrating for me because I couldn't get answers from anyone. But it also, I think, really made other people angry too, particularly my grandfather.
Yeah. And let's talk about your grandfather.
Yeah.
Pop Pop.
He just passed about a month ago now. He was one of the folks whose health I was concerned would be deteriorated too much before the book would come out. And he's such a like big figure in it that I felt like it would be too dishonest to try and wait and then publish this thing and have him never look at it. He was like a lot of men that I think we kind of hear about, like older black dude who works a lot, was, you know, looked over for a lot of opportunities. He did a lot of like raising himself, right? He spent a good amount of his life in prison. You know, he had several relationships, so he had a couple of his own kids. A lot of times in the 80s, 90s, a ton of folks were addicted to drugs, were in and out of prison, etc. Some of those folks, some of my relatives, were able to get clean and be relatively sober, right, compared to some other folks, and some weren't. And he was one of the folks who was able to, like, get a job, you know, mm-hmm. whatever that job was. And he was just very angry and tired. He was a very angry, tired person who did a lot of things that we could all agree were wrong. And there were moments in my life where we did not talk at all. But I started speaking to him again and kind of trying to figure out how to live ethically with him in my life to some degree.
Yeah, because your grandfather took care of you. He clearly loved you, but was very frustrated mm-hmm. by the lack of assistance he got in taking care yeah. of you and your siblings. And it seemed like you did have good memories, though.
Yeah, there were some. I mean, you know, and for a while, the violence that he perpetrated towards, like, my grandmother specifically, or to some of the kids, would overshadow those or make it so that there were no good memories or something like that. And that kind of complicates the image, I think, for me.
And I want to talk about another form of escape, which probably got you in some trouble.
Yeah.
And that was the animals. Oh. And I just want to say, too, even though there was a lot of trauma and violence, I laughed more often than I thought I would throughout the book. And one of the things I laughed at was the fact that you had tons of animals, firebelly newts, two lizards, an iguana, guinea pigs, frogs, toads. What was your love? Was this love for animals?
Part of it was like they felt like access to the outside world or something. And, you know, I start off the book thinking about a little bit, at least, Steve Irwin as a character, or like Animal Planet and all of those shows that were really popular at the time. I used to be watching those shows hours at a time, reruns, everything. And I would be like, oh, you know, I live here in Frankfurt. And in my mind, I was like, I'm never going to be able to leave. There's never a sense where my school was literally on the same street. But there was a pet shop around the corner called Birds, Birds, Birds. I would see all these animals in like Australia, Africa, Canada, or like Latin America or whatever. And for me, there was like a connection where I'm like, oh, I could have these pets and I could have this experience with them. And then it also ended up being a form of me practicing care for other living things and just assuming or trying to get these animals to like care for me in ways that people do with cats and dogs all the time now. And the strange part about it really was that they weren't just cats and dogs and that there were all these other kinds of animals, because I was like, this is simultaneously involving the outside, an outside that I felt like I couldn't reach or get close to.
So this was another form of escape. If you could look at that next excerpt, I believe it's on page 95. Mm-hmm. If you could read from the book on that.
$100 ain't even that much for a whole alligator, Joey thought, walking up Frankfurt Avenue, clutching crusted bills in one hand, feeling the other crumpled up ducat secure in his left sock. Always keep your money in two separate places, Pop-Up liked to say. And Joey remembered. He'd forgotten, though, that Philadelphia is a city of great seasons, that he himself had caught cold then pneumonia, and nearly died at some children's hospital, no thanks to his own body's shallow attempts at thermoregulation. He was forgetting weakness in favor of developing strength. The alligator was a part of that. And it was warm out now, the perfect temperature for an alligator. It was getting warmer all the time. And nothing lasts forever anyway, Joey thought. Best to get an alligator now before it was too late and put everything else off until later, if later ever came. The balding Chinese man at Birds, Birds, Birds was too excited about selling an alligator to Joey to inform him about care. He'd seen enough Animal Planet to know what alligators did anyway. Most of Joey and the man's chats had centered on Joey's questions, which always had to do with how big the various animals got and whether he could cuddle them or not. Even if the man would have said anything in caution, it's likely that Joey would have simply ignored him, knowing far better than to trust an adult. Nothing but lies and trickery, self-exceptions, excuses for why he should show them deference, but they never needed to show him respect, and so on. Either way, Joey had saved up $99.99 from cutting grass and shoveling snow with a patience he would run out of long before his own adulthood. This was long after he'd spent the money from hustling baby garter snakes on cheesesteaks and blue sodas, double cheeseburgers, and stockpiles of freeze-dried shrimp-flavored noodles in styrofoam cups. He spent his $20 allowance mostly on food, too. Before that, sure, he dabbled in geckos and newts for a while, considered a Savannah monitor, a black and white tegu twice, and even had an iguana named Lizzie in between. But an alligator, to have and to hold, would be the kind of real and otherworldly satisfaction that Joey had longed for through all the other dead animal bodies.
I just love that excerpt. It's so much mixed up in this love for animals. It's this desire to be loved, to cuddle with an alligator. Yeah. I laughed at that point.
They're so cute. Like baby alligators. People don't think, but like baby alligators are very, I think they're very cute.
And there was a search for love, because I see that as a theme throughout the entire memoir, is that you were constantly reaching outward for some form of love. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I think the animals were a really good sense of that, right? I mean, they're less complicated in a lot of ways. I don't want to say like, you know, complete and biologically less complicated, but in the ways that we think about love, I think there's a reason why people are like, I'm going to get all these cats or dogs or whatever, rather than having to work out things between other people, because that's harder. There's a lot of pain that can come from that. You know, there can be a lot of joy and ecstasy as well, but there's also a lot of pain from that. And you know, when I was like 8, 9, 10, my kind of practice endeavors had to do with animals, because I was both worried about like hurting other people in some way. And this is true when I think of early experiences with like sex. And I was also afraid of like being hurt by other people, both physically and emotionally. And, you know, that degree is far less when you were dealing with animals.
Yeah. I think about, too, the way you were teased, called all sorts of names before you even had a chance to figure out your sexuality. You use a lot of words to try to describe this, but you were kind of berated by the people around you who loved you before you even knew, I could imagine, you even knew what you wanted or didn't want.
Yeah, I feel like that's true for a lot of kids too, right? Even if they're not berated, I feel like a lot of kids hear the words about what is supposed to be an appropriate sexuality or relationship to people of the same or other sex. And so for me, it was really strange because I didn't understand why that was so important, why this kind of virility or ability to dominate or what have you was super important. And I mean, we know that the strictures from without on Black folks in particular and Black children tend to be like much tighter, right? People are super concerned with our sexualities from a very, very early age, from strangers to like people in your household. And, you know, I wanted to think about that from a perspective that was like prior to getting the language for it, which had a lot to do with where I wanted to start the book, right? So some of those earliest experiences of learning about the world had to do with you know, my body in relation to other people's bodies of the same and other sexes, and how I'm learning what I'm allowed to do, what I'm like not allowed to do, or what I should be doing or shouldn't be doing. Way before you get to categories of like straight or homosexual or queer or anything like that. And for me, I want to show like the way that the world kind of chooses for you ultimately. Yeah. Really early on, people choose for you kind of right away. And I'll say that for a lot of folks, like in my family, they didn't always feel like they were being mean. A lot of times, and this is true of my grandfather too, felt like, you know, my aunt, grandmother, mother, feel like they're doing what's necessary, right? To make sure that I am going to be like strong enough or manly enough or something within the world to both protect them and myself.
So you are currently getting your doctorate at the University of Pennsylvania. You have a MFA. And it's like, you know, you're this very educated person, well-read. So I want to take a moment and talk about education.
Yeah.
Like, what drew you to education and gave you that fire and desire and motivation to become such an educated person?
I gotta say, I'm a hypocrite because I hated school altogether. I could not stand it for most of my life. I mean, I eventually figured out that that had to do with a lot of other things about feeling comfortable and safe in school, which I still have anxieties about. So sitting in the classroom now, to this very day, I still don't always quite feel comfortable. But at a certain point in my life, maybe, you know, I didn't go to college until I was in my 20s, right? And I went to community college in Philly first, then I went to Arcadia, then St. Joe's. So I went to a bunch of like Philly-oriented schools, but I went to community college, which was super important for me, and I'm glad that I did. I felt like it was like designed to lock people like me and my family and folks that I knew out of it, because the threshold for entry, you know, it felt like there was all these people who had grown up in relative safety and had the time and the patience and parental figures. And so the barrier for entry was like people who already knew algebra, who already knew like all these things that I had never really understood or discovered. And I had to do a lot of catching up. And what I actually discovered, though, was that I get a lot of satisfaction from reading and thinking, from even doing math after I figured out how to do math altogether. And I couldn't find things that gave me that high level of satisfaction other than thinking.
It sounds like education helped you become who you truly are, your true self.
Yeah. Yeah, it did.
And so I guess when people read this memoir, sometimes they're wondering how someone who's been through so much trauma, who experienced so much growing up, could then come out and, you know, you seem like a really cool dude, you know, like, you know, and not necessarily like living the trauma now, you know, you're in a very different place, a place that a lot of people would applaud and cheer for. I guess in my mind, I'm wondering, why put out all of this? Why then just expose all of this part of yourself when you, quote, made it out? And that's something a lot of Black folks, you know, we're like, I'm going to bury that.
I'm going to tell anybody about this part. Yeah.
Why expose all of that as your debut?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many good questions in that, Cherry. Like, I feel like the dishonesty about one's actual experience and background, or like dishonesty might be too harsh for some folks, but the hesitancy to be honest about our own experiences and backgrounds make it a lot harder, I think, for folks who don't have what a lot of us now have to say anything at all, or to feel welcome in spaces that like are designed to foster intellectual experiences, or to feel comfortable like wanting things that are other or that are different.
What do you hope people take from reading this?
I hope people take one of the same things that I'm still working on when you say like not living the trauma, is that we really, really have to pay more attention to the interior lives of Black kids and not to think that everything is like kind of okay when they don't say anything. And, you know, to try and slow down and be more patient, I think, which is something I really, really struggle with, and kind of listening to those sets of concerns, because a lot of the ways that I thought then are, I think, still more sophisticated than some of the traps that I've fallen into now with regards to thinking and feeling.
Wonderful. Well, I've been talking with Philadelphia writer Joseph Earl Thomas about his debut memoir, Sink. It's about his difficult childhood growing up in Philadelphia's Frankfurt neighborhood and how he survived it. I'm glad you survived, Joe.
Yeah, me too.
It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you.
That was lovely, Cherry. What a great interview. I always find when I hear something like that, there's like one detail that just hits me. Mm-hmm. For some reason, keep your money in two places.
Yeah, that one from Pop Pop.
Yeah.
A little adage just, from
Pop Pop.
It tells
you so much about so many aspects of daily life for people mm-hmm. in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and he had an alligator living in his backyard.
That's a good
detail. And it
too.
Was just like, he's just such a cool guy and went through so much and turned out so well.
Yeah.
And shared it all. That's courage.
And is sharing, exactly.
Yeah,
the transparency,
courage.
the getting it out there. That was a great question, by the way. So we're going to do a hard pivot here.
Yes.
Coming up, we got the Studio 2 Trivia Challenge. Today's contestant is Nick from South Philly.
Ooh.
And Nick is waiting on the line. And of course, we'll also tell you about what to look forward to this weekend. WHYY's Tanya Pendleton has got you covered with great ideas. Stick with us on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I am Cherry Gregg. And it is time, it's Thursday, it's time for our Studio 2 Trivia Challenge. This is our second go-round. We're going to get real experience at this, Avi. And mm-hmm. we have a brave, courageous caller on the line. Today we have Nick from South Philly. Nick, are you ready?
Hi, I'm Nick.
Nick is ready.
Nick is ready. Nick, quick question. What'd you have for breakfast today?
Wheaties?
I did not. I had a green smoothie because I'm trying to be healthy, but I just finished my hoagie, so we're good to go.
breakfast and lunch of champions, setting them up for the win. Go
All right,
ahead,
Nick.
Avi.
I'm from South Philly, so you better represent here. I'm going to ask you a multiple choice question. If you get it right, you get a prized WHYY grocery tote bag. Are you Ooh. With me, Nick?
Let's do this.
Okay.
Love, Nick.
Here's the question. You got four choices here. Name the Delaware native who played the character April Ludgate on NBC's sitcom Parks and Recreation. Is that Delaware native named A, Aubrey Plaza, B, Terry Polo, C, Amy Poehler, or D, Elizabeth Shue? And walk me through your thought process here, Nick.
I wish I watched more Parks and Rec to know that.
Any names sound familiar to you or not?
Yeah, they do. I feel like the answer is A, but I don't feel confident and would love a lifeline.
There are no lifelines.
There are no lifelines.
We're integrating that into the game format later. So are you going to guess A or are you going to guess something else?
Yeah, my wife's going to be upset with me. I'm going to say A.
All right. And guess what? You're right! Aubrey Plaza. And we're going to play a quick clip to as a reminder.
You guys are my idea factory. April, go.
Okay, I got one. Macaroni and poison. It's like mac and cheese, but with a special ingredient.
There you go. Plaza went to high school at Ursuline Academy in Wilmington. Apparently, she's named Aubrey after a 1970s hit by the band Bread
called Aubrey. Congratulations, Nick.
Hey, representing South Philly for you.
And you are getting a tote bag. We will be in touch about getting you that tote bag. By the way, if you want to follow in Nick's footsteps and be the next Studio 2 Trivia contestant, you got to leave a message at this number. Listen carefully. 215-351-0525. That's 215-351-0525. Now we're going to wrap up the week turning to WHYY's Tanya Pendleton, who has a fantastic list of things to do this weekend.
It's understandable if you're confused about your weekend attire with temperatures swinging from freezing to balmy. But this weekend, the temps look to be in our favor as the forecast shows a sunny, warm weekend ahead.
I'm living, living for the weekend. I'm just living, yes I am.
So let's go, my friend. Let's head outside. It's cherry blossom season, and that means the Cherry Blossom Festival. Sakura Weekend is happening on Saturday and Sunday at Fairmont Park's Horticultural Center. Each day gets started at 10:30 a.m., and you can enjoy the beautiful blossoms until 4 p.m. As you may know, they don't last long, which the Japanese believe illustrates the ephemeral nature of all things. The free festival has a ticketed kickoff performance on Friday, and on Sunday, there's the Prettiest Pet in Pink Parade. We'll have all the info on our website, whyy.org/things to do. The annual Holi Festival, celebrated by billions of Hindus worldwide, is best known for the throwing of colored powder on its participants. On Saturday, the Philadelphia Zoo hosts the Festival of Colors.
Do me a favor, let's play Holi.
The festival includes food, dance, and music, and is said to symbolize the triumph of good over evil. Now that's something to celebrate. It starts at noon and is free with zoo admission. It's going to be such a nice weekend. Let's stay outside. Bartram's Garden welcomes the season with their annual Spring Fest on Saturday. This year's theme is the beauty of urban ecology. There will be meditation, drumming, and a workshop with the Academy of Natural Sciences. The free all-ages event starts at 10 a.m. The Clover Market begins its 14th season on Sunday. The curated outdoor market of vintage and handmade finds makes its first stop in Chestnut Hill, heading to three more locations on Sundays through October. You can find it this Sunday on Highland and Germantown Avenues. It goes from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's time to head inside, but for good reason. The Sixers are in the playoffs.
I'm excited about the playoffs. I feel good. You know, I feel good about myself and my team. So I just want to make sure that, you know, all of us, we get that healthy and, you know, we do what we got to do.
We know some of you are considering rooting for the Brooklyn Nets since Mikal Bridges is a two-time NCAA champ with Villanova. Sorry, we have to draw lines here. It's all about our MVP, Joel Embiid, so you're going to have to keep that under wraps, Nova fans. The Sixers open the playoffs at home on Saturday, and game time is 1 p.m. There are still tickets, so no excuses not to get out and root for the home team in person. Love soul music? I mean, really love it? Because if you do, you're already familiar with this voice.
Keep holding on to your thoughts of rejection.
That's Mint Condition lead singer Stokely Williams. The band is part of the Minneapolis sound that was put on the map by that purple guy. After two decades, Stokely has gone solo and he still sounds and looks amazing.
Today I woke up to breakfast in bed and I wanna bite. You know that coffee in the morning does me right.
He's at the Event Center at Rivers Casino on Friday at 8 p.m. They're one of the most successful bands of all time. And when you're that good, you usually have a tribute band. Chicago has sold millions of records and been inducted into the Grammy and Rock and Roll Halls of Fame, so their tribute band has to be outstanding. And they are. Beginnings is at the Levoy Theater in South Jersey on Saturday night, playing the music of Chicago. The show starts at 8. We're ready to get our weekend started, so we're at the end of this week's edition of Things to Do. I'm Tanya Pendleton, and we'll be back next Thursday to give you the weekend's best options. In the meantime, head to whyy.org/things to do for more information about new plays and exhibits opening this week and where you can find wine and daffodils together in Delaware. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
Long time.
Love it, love it, love it. Are you going to play to see the Sixers play in the playoffs on Saturday?
No, I wish. Yeah, no, I'll watch it at home.
I'll watch it too.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the price. It's the baby at home.
Yeah,
I'll be doing it with the baby in one arm. Yeah, but it would be a good Saturday for a Saturday in the park, by the way. Shout out Chicago, because the weather's been crazy.
Yeah,
and it's going to be pretty nice over the weekend.
It's going to be pretty nice, and I want to see the cherry blossoms. I want to see, you know, everything.
This is the season.
This is the season. So that is it for Studio 2 today. For more of our show, you can head on over to whyy.org/studio2 and follow WHYY on Twitter. Of course, we use the hashtag Studio 2, like the number.
We've got three people to thank. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Marie Bessler. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us.